neat new ways, challenged and enlightened, and it feels very good. If I were you, I'd be very suspicious of anyone who puts up a PowerPoint presentation about suffering, right? Tell you 13 things you need to know about suffering. Write these down, there'll be a quiz tomorrow. I would like to talk about suffering with you tonight, and especially how Christians and other people of faith have explained suffering in light of God, and God in light of suffering, and how others are nervous about that enterprise, and maybe some of the promise of thinking about suffering in light of God's goodness and God's power, and some of the problems that go along with that, some of the dead ends or streets you won't want to go down when you think about that. When I first met my wife, Laura, her mom had died a year or two before we met, and I told her that one of my academic interests, right, was the problem of suffering, suffering as it relates to Christianity. And she called me out right away. She said, from where are you speaking, right? What have you gone through where you're speaking that? And it's a great question, right? Is this an academic enterprise, kind of thinking about suffering from an abstract point of view, theoretical point of view, or is it really reflective on our own pains and brokenness in our lives? I hope it's the latter. And in fact, part of what I'll say is that we can think different ways about suffering, and some of them are more productive and more faithful than others. Eventually, we're going to turn to the book of Job, some passages, and read the book of Job, and think about how that marvelous, weird, odd book of the Bible might help orient us in how we think about suffering in light of God. So we'll get there eventually. As always, I am just a kind of conversation leader here. I will go through a few things to get us going, but when we get going, we'll really be leaning on one another to help think these problems through and think what the best approaches might be. So here we go. I'm tapping. I wonder if our
are you handling the
suffering? We're the anxiety rate.
Did it go to sleep? Did it go to sleep?
I think my, yeah. But
I think it's this thing.
Yeah, that one is on. So this
one. Yes, I think my battery is good. Are we good?
Is it just turned
off. Okay.
It happened to me yesterday, Jason, so don't
do
that.
Okay.
Where's the tech people?
Maybe
we have to push something up.
Yeah,
I think that's fine.
No.
Please wait.
Yeah, that helps. See,
this, this teaches me.
Have you wiggled the hook up in the back of the computer?
Can I try something on your keyboard?
The big one.
Well, I just restarted this. Oh, okay. I thought it was the keyboard, but it must be the
This is why teachers who are older than 60 just use a blackboard to chalk.
Well,
if
it doesn't stir up.
So,
you don't want touch the connection between your computer and that. Is it on or did it come out? Because it's searching. That's on. It's looking for your.
Yeah.
Now we should see a cute picture of my kids. So that's exactly right. Suffering.
Oh, nice.
Does anyone know my
It's suffering.
Suffering.
Oh, thank
Aww.
You. Thank you. Thanks for your patience. Sorry.
For two kids, yeah.
Now we get to see a whole life.
Yeah, right. No more too close. It goes by all.
Look at all the articles you've written.
There's a lot of suffering. if this goes out again, we'll go with, we'll take it as a sign from God and go with it.
Stop sign.
Okay, here we go. How many people are familiar with the word theodicy? Is that a lunchroom table? Show of hands, a few, maybe through profession, pastors and other folks. That's technically what we're talking about today, explanations of suffering in light of God's goodness and God's power. It comes from two Greek words. First one's for God, theos, and the second one's dike, meaning justification usually, or justice. Technically then, the theodicy problem, or the enterprise of theodicy, would be justifying God, or the justification of God in light of the problem of evil, or in light of suffering. And I'm going to use those two terms as pretty synonymous. So people who do theodicy, if you can do it, are those who want to make a case for belief in God in light of suffering. So they're bothered by this problem. We'll get more into it. Here's the problem, sometimes called the problem of evil. I meant to make this as abstract as possible with this diagram, because we're going to return to this. But here's the problem. Imagine someone wearing a three-piece suit at this point, right? Pointing us to this problem. God is all-powerful or omnipotent. Many of us, most of us, all of that, all of us maybe believe this. God is all good, and yet something like evil exists. The world is not as it should be. Suffering happens. The bumper sticker reads, S-H-I-T happens, right? We all know the world is not as it should be, right? And this is a problem, a kind of conceptual problem for many people. Let's spell it out just a little bit differently here. If God were all good, God would want to do something about suffering. In other words, this is not the God that many of us believe in, right? Kind of capricious God. Smite, yeah, smite is the key.
Smite.
That's not our God. Our God is good, loving, caring, benevolent. And so God would want to do something about suffering. God's all-powerful. God would be able to do something about suffering, right? This isn't our God either, darn, right? A God out of control of the universe, right? And so a real problem for many develops out of this kind of conceptual deadlock, this trilemma, some people call it, of how to hold those three things together. Something seems like it's going to have to give. One of the famous books is by a Jewish rabbi called When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and that is the problem of theodicy, trying to think through, I don't deserve this, or this person I know doesn't deserve this. It seems like this suffering is unwarranted. God is all good. God would want to do something about it. God is all powerful. God should be able to do something about it. And yet there's a tremendous amount of pain, as all of us know, either firsthand, secondhand, some combination of the two. Does that problem make sense? We're going to talk more about whether that's the right problem to have, whether it's the right question to present. But does it make just sense as a kind of question, right? Seems like something's going to have to get redefined. Maybe suffering doesn't really exist. Maybe God's not all-powerful in the way we normally think of that. Maybe not God's not all-good as we normally think of it. Lots of other responses. Question or comment?
I was just going to say, maybe there's way too many assumptions behind those.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that. Yeah. I'm setting this up a little bit, and I hope I'm not overly, you know, setting us up. This is a common way of talking about the problem of evil. And so we're going to indulge it for a little while and then take a step back and ask whether that's the right question. Let's assume it's a good question. And would you please turn to someone else or a group of three or four and solve it?
No.
No, it's a good response, right? Obviously, we're not going to. But we do have, I think, some immediate things that we want to say. Well, power doesn't mean this, or goodness doesn't mean this, or suffering doesn't mean this, or if you think about this and this light, we seem to get out of the problem. I think many of us have some early responses. Share them, if you would. How do you respond to this problem of suffering presented in this way? 5 minutes to solve the problem of evil? Shouldn't take Now you really feel set up. Is that right? Really feel set up? Some initial responses. And if you already want to talk about the problem with thinking of it this way, that's fine. But before we share as a group, share with one another, if you would. Okay, talk through it. And if you don't feel like talking through it, talk through why you don't want to talk through it. To this problem of suffering, and then ask if some of these classical responses sound familiar based on what you discussed in your group. And at that time, if you want to say, well, we said something like that, but we talked about this, then we'll ask for people to name some of the course of the conversation at that time.
And you'll tell us which one of us is right?
Yes, there's a right answer. I have it in my back pocket, and you get free ice cream if you guess. No.
I don't think that's good.
It's not good. All right. Where were we? There are two real, probably I consider, historically speaking, over couple of thousand years of Christian history, two real primary responses to this theodicy problem. And they entail a number of other responses that are compatible. These are in no way mutually exclusive. A lot of people draw from both of them, but they're really common ones, and I'll talk about those first. This is sometimes called the free will defense. Augustine is sometimes thought about the popularizer or even the originator of this view. It's the response that suffering isn't from God. It's from humanity. God created the world good. It was good. It was good. It was very good. And it would be very good. There wouldn't be suffering if humanity hadn't mucked it up. Right? And we can appeal to the story of Genesis 3, Adam and Eve, or we can think more personally about our own lives and us as collectively. We make the bed that we lie in somehow. Human suffering is a result of human sin. God is off the hook or justified, right? We can believe in God and God's goodness and omnipotence because God's not to blame or the cause of suffering. We are, essentially. My suffering may not be because I've sinned, and hopefully we don't go around and try and connect the dots, right? Who sinned that this man was born blind? Him or his parents? Mm-hmm. Quoting John, right? Neither, but so that the glory of God could be shown. But somehow, because all of us sin, all of us are in this together, right? Of course, we're familiar with those folks who do go and connect the dots, right? There's a hurricane in Katrina. Somebody's going to come up with some sort of theory that it's because gay folks live there or because America is no longer supporting Israel the way that they should or whatever other theory we come up with. Hopefully we don't do this. Hopefully it's more broad and say we're fallen and we live in a fallen world and suffering is part of the consequence of that fallenness. In its most extreme case, there would be really no such thing as innocent suffering. Of course, I could be innocent. I'm not. I could be and I suffer, but we collectively aren't innocent. We're fallen. And so all suffering is, in some sense, deserved. Now, there's one of two ways you could spin that. It's all punishment. And here, Augustine is hard, and I don't like him much, right? That we get what we deserve, and this is punishment for our sin. Or another way of thinking about it would be that suffering is the result. It's about brokenness, not about punishment for our sin. But the whole creation has been rent asunder because of sin, and we live in a broken world that's in need of redemption. And suffering is part of the human condition and even the world's condition because of human sin, whatever that would mean. I think that's all I had on that. Yeah, so before we go here, let's ask if people mention this, or another question that I think we should address is, what are the pros and the cons? What's alluring about this kind of response? What's positive or what jives with our experience? And where does it lead us down a dead-end street? Paul, you were...
Human sin, what does that have to do with volcanoes and hurricanes and tsunamis? And
right.
That's my question.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the dead-end streets,
right?
Right. Augustine in Moments will say, right, that there would be no tsunamis without human sin. Or they would happen in some remote area where no one would be affected. Everything would be for the good, right? And then all of that. But when pressed, right, we don't want to go there. Right? That there's no such thing as natural evil. There's only moral evil if this were our only response. Does that language make some sense? Mm-hmm. There'd be no acts of God, whatever we call them, just things happening. Everything would be the result of human disobedience. It's hard when pressed that far. Yeah.
What if reality doesn't have any bad or good, and this is an assumption that we make because we need to understand it. We want to make it mean something. It's just what it is.
Knowing good and evil.
It is. And there's maybe even a benefit or something to be gained from suffering. There's a purpose that God would allow it because he knows that innocence being suffering is the only way some people open their eyes. Whether it's the pelicans that did nothing wrong, that are encased in oil, and we can blame someone else, we can say, blame this gasoline. I mean, suffering has a purpose.
Mm-hmm. That's going to take us more into the second response, not looking backward at the origin, but forward to what good might come out of it. And also, I think your early comments talking about suffering itself exists, maybe we don't know what that means. Maybe we're
it's
not
the result.
We're doing it, not sure. Yeah, thanks. Other comments or other groups that talk something like a free will response?
Yeah, I feel that God created the world. He set up certain laws of nature. And if we try to disobey those laws, something's going to happen. Maybe bad, maybe good. But for example, I don't want to offend anybody, but we know that if you smoke cigarettes, you have a much bigger chance of getting lung cancer than if you don't. Now, there are people that get lung cancer that don't ever smoke in their life, others that don't. But does God hate smokers more than he hates everybody else?
No.
No, no. God. But what he's saying, what I'm saying is that there are certain laws, and we know what they are, and we have free will, and we can make decisions. And God is not treating us like a puppet on a string. We have our free choice. We can do what we want to do. But God said, this is the rules of the game, and if you disobey the rules, something might happen.
And that speaks to the power of this and how it does fit some circumstances. I mean, we do know suffering that is the result of...
And we don't know things down to the micro level of why things happen. We aren't that smart. I mean, the doctors aren't that smart that they can figure that out. But,
Or you say.
So yeah, this can be a very powerful response, and I think it's a common one as well. Please.
Some of my teachers have taught me that creation was not a singular event. In the past, but it was started as a process and it's ongoing, and we're participating even now in the creation.
And Augustine isn't thinking that way so much this way. I mean, he's really thinking about creation is done in 7 days and it's complete.
Trash can for it is.
What's that?
Some of us have a special trash can.
Trash can for Augustine, yeah. This may not be Augustine.
Sorry about that.
Right. But that understanding too, that creation is ongoing, I think would appeal more to this second response. Anyone else? I don't want to miss people up here, too. Other people talk about a free will defense? Or anyone want to speak again about the power of this? It's powerful. Maybe too powerful. We know people who, when suffering happens, their immediate response is to say, what did I do? Or what did we do? Right? But whether that's good or bad, it speaks to some of the power of those. Let's go back here and then up here, Tom, as well.
What's interesting is that for a lot of that argument, free will had to be connected with sin, rather than just the idea that when we have free will, we make decisions, and we might not be fully informed, but if God were to intercede for us, that would sort of be more like predetermined. It would eliminate our free will. And so it just seems like we make decisions, and they might even be good decisions, but because of the decisions we make and a million other people make, and none of them might... They don't even have to be simple decisions, but just the occurrences happen that cause suffering to happen.
Thanks. Yeah, I think this whole theory is presupposed on our free will and consequences following.
It seems to me that Jesus said he walked away from the question. He said he didn't give us an answer to the why. It's obviously here. You could argue about it all night long. And he showed us what to do when there's suffering. He didn't say go out and answer whether it's from sin or didn't criticize God from it, but here's what you do. You help the Samaritan. And it's theology of the cross rather than whatever the alternative is. And so I think he, in a way, dismissed the question. Yeah.
That's where I was going to end. So we're done. Yeah. And we're already... And I hope that many of us are doing this. We're already suspicious of thinking about it this way, and we should be. But again, I want to make a case. This is really, really common. Big books written like this, and this problem presented like this is common. So we got to get into it long enough to find our way out of it as well. Okay. Let's go on to the second really common one. Divine pedagogy. This is popularized by a philosopher of religion named John Hick. In this century or past century, 20th century, but he goes back to Irenaeus and some of the early Greek thinkers, theologians, as well as Friedrich Schleiermacher. That's fun to say at lunch, Schleiermacher. His point here is, unlike Augustine, don't try to go back and find out where suffering came from. That's what Augustine's doing, right? We can't go back and blame it on God. You can only go as far back as human sin for Augustine. But he's looking for the origin of suffering. Hick is saying, and others who talk this way, is don't look for the origin. Look for the telos, where it's going or where it might go. Point is not to look backward, but where it might go. God created the world good, but not perfect. Perfection lies in the future. And you can play with some of the Hebrew here. The word for good, very good, is very different than perfect. And so while creation might have been given whole, it's not as though for these folks that's the final state. It still needs to move somewhere. And then suffering might be a kind of passage from good to perfect, or be the way that we develop souls. Some call this a soul-making theodicy, borrowing from the poet John Keats, or for more moral growth. And I can speak this way as a parent, and many of us are that. You know, when we decide when the toddler starts to walk, right, how many corners of the table do we put tennis balls on, or whatever we do to protect, right? And we have to decide, right, how much am I going to save my child from, or when do I let him or her get hurt so that they learn? These folks think about God in the same way, right? Suffering, or at least the possibility of suffering, is the chance God takes so that we will grow up morally and spiritually, will develop virtue or become selves. All suffering may turn out to look like labor pains or growing pains, the painful process of maturing spiritually. So again, three questions. Did anyone talk about this in their groups? It'd be great to hear in your own words. And then what are the pros? Where does this speak to us? And where are the cons? Where do we feel like, well, not if we think about it in this way? Yeah, thanks.
I think that makes me really nervous. And it speaks a little bit to the purpose that you were talking about earlier, in that it's a large price to pay. I think about suffering like genocide, and that's just a really awful, it's a huge amount of human suffering that teaches us a lesson. And so I think that this model really makes me nervous about using this suffering to gain something for ourselves.
Well, kind of the other part of this theory is that the suffering is going to lead to, you know, sometime in the future to some perfect event that creates this perfect world, and that all the suffering that's gone before us and that has been will be worth this price that we paid.
The end is going to justify the means in some, or we could hope for. But right, with some kinds of suffering are easier to fit in this model than others. Right? We know suffering that's productive. I've seen my wife give birth. That looks like a tremendous amount of pain, but productive. She assures me it was painful. But genocide, right, is that worth the end point? Yeah, thanks.
I feel nervous about this as well, because the temptation is to say God is causing the suffering in order to teach you the lesson, when it's not that you can't get something good from the suffering with God's help, but
this response isn't going to get God off the hook in the same way as Augustine's response in some ways. God is to blame or responsible for suffering, but only insofar as suffering is a kind of thoroughfare to fully actualize selves, however we talk about that, virtue.
And it begs the question, is suffering necessary to learn that?
Yeah, right. Let's go here.
The first question that was asked kind of got me thinking about sort of the parental metaphor of why suffering happens, like you were describing the tennis ball situation. But that is still sort of problematic for me, because I was a chaplain in a hospital and spent a lot of time on the oncology wing. And while I did see or experience other people telling me about how changing their how life-changing their experience of cancer was, if you ever come into a room and say, oh, you know, in the end, this will be good for you, you know, find the silver lining, that is extraordinarily damaging coming from, I may have a little piece of this in my theology, but you can't come into a room with that, and I can't reconcile that either, and I can't even my own head go, yeah, there's something good, it's just all bad. And so maybe there is something about the future that's important, but you can't access that in the present. And it's almost, I mean, to me it's sinful to almost look towards that in the right now, because you have to, there's a point where you have to just be in the suffering and get suffering for what it is, and I don't know why, but I began to understand that spending a lot of time on ecology.
So you're saying don't try and fix the problem, walk through the problem with them?
Just, yeah, I don't know, be in the infinitude of that moment, or be in, Bonhoeffer talks about the penultimate versus the ultimate, and we can't always be pointing where we're going, we have to just be in right now.
So it matters who's saying this. You don't walk in a room and say, this will be okay, some good will come out of it. That's a horrific thing to say.
And it's damaging.
Yeah. Yeah. Dismissive, right. Yeah.
Over here and here, and then we'll and up there, and then we'll move on as well. Thanks.
And briefly as possible, the history of Christianity from very, very early, even first century on, had people persecuting and fighting with each other and killing each other over doctrinal ideas, whereas there were some people who did not try to couch everything in doctrine, but just wanted to live a way of life. They wanted to be followers, disciples of Jesus' way, and they were sometimes so brutally attacked by the people who wanted to make it a system of doctrine. And I know this has something to do with it, because you mentioned some of the names of those people, like Augustine and Irenaeus and so on. I don't think that Jesus wanted people to make creeds and doctrines. I think Jesus wanted people to recognize the kingdom of God as a gracious Father, giving whatever is needed to his children.
Maybe another way of getting at this issue about explaining, which takes us away from suffering, maybe keeps it at arm distance and engaging it in a different way. Was it here, and then up here, and then we're going
to... For me, it's so easy to see it as it's somehow, because I'm looking at it, I'm assuming that it's my game, and therefore it should be somehow. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it's not our game, and it's all of us. And even though it's suffering, if it makes us more dependent on God, that doesn't even benefit him as much as it benefits us. Because we see our limitations, and we can't change everything, but we can have to trust, I guess, that if God is loving, and he loves us this much, you're loved. I mean, you can't judge him, because how small a box do you want to put him in? I mean, you know, it's...
Thanks.
I think that one thing that's really important to remember in this discussion is how unequally suffering is distributed. And one thing that I have that I can't reconcile myself to is the idea that, like, any suffering that I have experienced or will ever experience is so small in comparison to the kind of, you know, abuse and cruelty and inhumanity that lots of other people suffer on a daily basis. And I don't understand a philosophy where, because of that level of suffering somewhere else in the world, then through that, like, those people are learning to have, are going to have a better life eventually, because maybe they won't. And it certainly, some of the suffering in abject poverty somewhere else doesn't help me doesn't help my soul progress.
Just incidentally, when I poll undergraduate students, when I ask them questions like this to respond to this problem, this seems to be the one more often than not that comes up. I think it says something about our cultural instincts, our society. I mean, we do look for the positive spin on things. We see news reports about tragedy, and the next report is almost always the kind of community coming together out of this. We almost need it or want it, I think, as a culture. And so resisting that, I think, in the wise ways that people are doing here, celebrating when good does come out of tragedy, but resisting forcing it out of it, right? Or minimizing tragedy because we're flippantly optimistic that their good must prevail, I think is really wise as Christians to do. But this is powerful rhetoric. This is a powerful, Jeff.
One thing that limits our ability to talk about the whole matter is that there's so many kinds of suffering, and we're talking about all as one big thing.
Right.
And I might say something that can be helpful for a particular kind of suffering, but somebody else is hearing it in relationship to something else that's very, very different. So I could say something that might be helpful to the kind of suffering that someone who has a chronic, painful disease that they have to deal with. There might be something there that we can say about that. But then somebody takes that and applies that to something like the Holocaust, and then everything gets all mucked up. So we need more words for suffering.
Yeah. I think that's very wise, and hopefully we're getting closer. One more comment, I promise. You raise your hand, I'm going to ignore you. No.
This theory would seem to encourage people to seek out suffering, because the more you suffer, the more you grow.
Mm-hmm.
And
we know these kinds of piety, right? I mean, a kind of tendency towards masochism or sadism in some Christian circles, in some traditions, and they should make us nervous, right? Yeah, the one who suffers the most must be the most redeemed.
The winner.
Yeah, the winner. Right, it's dangerous. I'll do this very quickly. Just other things that often get tacked on with these kinds of responses. Compensation theory, fancy way of talking about afterlife, right? A lot of people say, yeah, we see a chunk, but the good will be rewarded and the wicked won't, or however we think about that, right? Very common way. Augustine and others have talked about evil or suffering isn't real, actually. It's a privation of the good, privatio bono. It's a kind of shadow of the good, so to say that suffering exists is already a wrong way of putting it. Suffering doesn't exist. Suffering is a kind of limit to God's creation. We don't think of this way much anymore, but it's not actually real. It's kind of the end point of what's real, but it's a kind of response. And then we could also think about the cosmos, the world, as a great big painting, mosaic maybe, where suffering is bad and painful if we look at it too closely. But if we could pull back and see the whole, it would be beautiful, along with everything else, right? The dark spots are needed to make the whole composition beautiful. Again, each of those, I think, has some strengths. They speak to some of our pieties and weaknesses, right? Don't tell a person who's got cancer to pull back and see the big picture. Bad pastoral care, I would think. Some of you know that better than I.
Is there, you mentioned Kirchner's book up here.
Yeah.
Didn't Kirchner have the idea that God is perfecting himself, he's growing? God's growing. He's changing and getting more understanding or something.
Yeah, I think it's a version of the divine pedagogy. But yeah, God is in this process of creation with humanity, and suffering is the opportunity to grow from it. Although he makes a lot of nice qualifications and reservations too. He's a kind of process theologian for those of you who know that. I'm gonna, I think, skip over this part. Besides just saying, theodicy could be a very narrow intellectual exercise like we're doing it here. I think that it's wider than that too, that our culture, our churches, our societies do try to make meaning out of suffering or in light of suffering. And we do this all the time in some ways. And the degree to which we're self-reflective about what we're doing and how we're doing that, I think is valuable. But we won't spend much time. We've already started to name these. Let's give a chance to name three more. Problems with this problem of evil. What's wrong or misplaced with thinking about suffering in light of, or in terms of the problem as presented here, this trilemma, this dilemma? What are some of the reservations you have about discussing it this way? We've mentioned a lot of them. There's all kinds of suffering, right? Or it depends who's talking about this. What other reservations do you have with the problem?
We make a lot of assumptions about the character and nature of God. that aren't necessarily something that we know for certain or is applicable to everyone. So my concept of who God is or what God is very, could be very different from the next person.
Yeah, good. Let me piggyback just a little way. I think that's so incredibly wise. To say that God is omnipotent and God is omnibenevolent is not biblical language. These are philosophical principles, propositional statements. God is all powerful, right? Doesn't say that in the Bible, although many of us believe in that God, right? But in other words, these kind of characteristics of God are abstracted from a story of God's ongoing interaction with God's people and the whole of creation. Right, and made into principles, and we don't really even know what they mean, given that way, right? Might be better to read the story of God's election of Israel, right? And think about God in that light, rather than in this, God is all good. Very different way of thinking about God, I think. That's wise. A couple more, yeah, thanks.
Okay. I mean, we have the capacity to understand.
Yeah. We get back to the PowerPoint, right? As if we know what we're talking about when we put up this triangle, right? And we know what this means, we know what this means, we know what this means. It almost turns into a kind of conceptual puzzle, doesn't it? That we're trying to wrap our brains around, rather than thinking of ourselves within that problem and grappling our way through in a very different way.
We're having a theory of mystery.
Yeah, right. We don't know. We could be much more ignorant. I see your hand, but let me pause here just because you've contributed well already. Someone else maybe we haven't heard from yet. We haven't heard much from you.
Well, I think if we assume that, if we take the assumption that God is omnipotent, and then we also, I think it follows from that that he would have created the perfect world. And this is obviously not it. So how do you, I just find that assumption to be false straight off the bat.
So again, we want to beg the question of what these terms mean. Paul?
Suffering and evil aren't always connected. One doesn't lead or come from the other much of the time. And a lot of times, suffering comes out of the absurd period. Comes out of the absurd.
Yeah, the whole premise of this is that there must be an answer, there must be a reason, an explanation. That's what we're after here, where either appeal to mystery or absurd, right? And there's value of just calling this absurd. This is bad, just sheer bad, and we don't know what to do with it. That may be a better form of faith than figuring it out in some wooden sense. Dale, last comment here, and we'll move on.
Okay, the whole creation, God created the whole creation around the principle of entropy, that energy is always dissipating, and all of nature is death and coming to life, death and coming to life. Mm-hmm. And so if we begin to call that suffering as we experience it as humans, we're, you know, it's the natural process of life.
Which may be a theodicy, it might be a response to this problem, or a way of naming the unanswerability of this.
And you may have heard the image, which was interesting, it's been used quite a bit now. If all the insects in the world were to die today, the world would be done. In a very short time. Yeah. If all the humans were to die today, the earth would flourish.
It might be an improvement.
Let's stick around anyway. I think we've covered all this. A pretty abstract language here, although really common, right? I think Christians need to say at some point, what God are you talking about? I don't believe in a philosophical God who has philosophical attributes that I can name with propositions. I believe in a God as revealed in Scripture, a God of story, a God who reveals God's self through God's ongoing interaction with God's creation and God's people.
And preserves
through
mystery.
Jesus. And preserves mystery. Yeah, we don't figure that God out. Yeah, my wife is mysterious to me, but not as a problem. Well, that too, but because I love her, right? God's a mystery not so that we figure that out, but because God has all the love and the will and the agency of anyone else that we're in communion with, like that. And then what kind of problem? It's a pretty conceptual problem set up like this. There's certainly different and perhaps better ways of thinking about and responding to suffering. Let me summarize the book of Job. real quickly. You all, maybe not all, but many of us know this story. Crazy, crazy story, right? Great story to read from beginning to end and take it in as a story. You can do it by a creek here, I think. It doesn't take too long. Here's the story, and then we'll look at a few passages and just a little hint of the way this story from the Hebrew Bible might be pointing us to something different than explaining the suffering, which might amount to explaining it away. Job was a righteous man in the eyes of the Lord. He was blessed with a lot of material goods and a large family. The book of Job makes the point of saying that Job is innocent, and not just sinless, but whole, righteous, good, and pious, in a non-negative sense. Pious would pray not only for himself, his own soul, but his children, and would make sacrifices in case someone else inadvertently sinned. And the book of Job says that he's righteous and sinless. Satan, who doesn't mean the prince of evil, but a kind of, again, trickster character, we used this language when we were talking about Genesis 3 earlier, is walking through the heavenly court after walking to and fro the earth. And God's bragging a little bit. Have you considered my servant Job? Pretty good guy. And Satan says, well, you've made him rich and enclosed him in a gated community. Who would worship you? He's untouched. I dare you, I'll bet you, that you take that prosperity away and you inflict him with suffering and he'll curse you. He'll stop worshiping you. Weird story, right? God says, that's on. Just don't touch him physically. So Satan takes away his family. They die, his livestock. And Job blesses God. They repeat the same cycle. Satan comes back and they up the ante, and now Satan is allowed to inflict pain on him. He's covered with boils and sores. These, by the way, are the drawings from William Blake, who illustrated the Job. They're very powerful drawings. And Job's wife says, "You, what's a good translation? You stupid? You..." So, anyway, some of the names that Laura has let slip with me sometimes. Curse God and die, and he praises God's name. And three friends come, and for 7 days, 7 nights, they keep quiet, and they just sit with Job on the dung heap, on the garbage heap. They're sitting in that S-H-I-T together. And then one of them starts up, they start trying to offer words of comfort, these friends of Job. Can we say a word? Now, a good question at this point in the story, are they being helpful? Are they comforting? Or whom are they serving? Who are they trying to help? Perhaps it's their own discomfort at having their explanations for suffering taken away. And we'll look at a couple of those passages here. But the friends gradually, nicely at first, and then more vehemently try to explain his suffering. Certainly you must have done something, Job. We know that no one who's innocent perishes. Certainly there must be something, or some good will come out of this. They're the theodicists in some ways, as we'll see. Getting to the end of the story, then we'll backtrack. Elihu, a fourth figure, comes in, gives his own kinds of response. Finally, God answers Job out of the whirlwind. And by the way, Job, throughout these interactions, most of the book is comprised of the interactions between Job and his friends. Job is the only one to address God. And Job is not happy. These are not solemn prayers. Job is angry with God and shakes his fist at God and wants to have some answers to why he is suffering. God finally answers Job out of the whirlwind. Has a long speech. We'll read a little bit of it. Much of it amounts to, who are you to question me, Job? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? He talks about Leviathan and the hippopotamus, all these sea creatures, magnificent symbols of chaos, and says, Job, you're so small. My world is so big. And Job gets blessed by God at the end. And the friends are not blessed. And we'll read a passage there. And the nice little happy story, happy ending to the story, Job gets double back what he lost. Now, I don't know how you feel, but I'm deeply dissatisfied with that. If my family was taken, that I could have two wives and four kids rather than two, I don't know if that'd be... But as a story...
Sounds like a punishment.
As a story... as the story, it is framed with the loss and then the restoration as the end. So it kind of works that way. We have about 10 minutes left. I wondered if, with our few Bibles here, some folks would be responsible for reading some of these passages. Why don't we take a little bit of these away and just, how about we do four of them? Would somebody who has a Bible close by be willing to look up Job 4, 1 through 8? Who is that? Thanks. Would somebody read Job back to his friends from chapter 13? Bible somewhere? Thanks. Somebody Job to God? Oh, 30, 20. Let's see. Job to God. I'll do that one because I didn't write it down. Write it. And then God to Job, 41, 1 through 5, someone else? Great, thanks. Friends to Job, here's just an example of how they speak to him. And this is really early. It's actually the first words out of Eliphaz's mouth. You have that?
Yeah.
This is after they sit for 7 days, seven nights, being good comforters with Job in his pain, and then here goes.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? But who can keep from speaking? See, you have instructed many. You have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have supported those who were stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and so trouble reap the same."
Really powerful, those last couple verses, isn't it? He's not saying, Job, you must have done something wrong at this point. It's almost like kind of abstract language. Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? The implications, of course, are, Job, you must have done something. And this gets back to your nice comment, right? Yeah, a general truth. And asking Job, right, to apply it to his life, impose it maybe on his own experience, right, impose this doctrine. And we have other explanations. This would be a kind of free will defense, right? The innocent don't perish. Job, you must have done something. We have other explanations of hang in there, good comes out of evil, from the other friends as well. They're the theodicists. They're explaining in this way. And I think you can read him as trying to give comfort, but it's not working with Job. Job's line back to the friends. Who had this one?
I did.
Thanks, Jeff.
"Look, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewashed with lies. All of you are worthless physicians. If you would only keep silent, that would be your wisdom. Hear now my reasoning and listen to the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? Or can you deceive him as one person deceives another? He will surely rebuke you if in secret you show partiality. Will not his majesty terrify you and the dread of him fall upon you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay."
Think about that language, defenses, right? And their maxims. You almost think of like philosophical principles or doctrines that they're kind of imposing. And he's saying they're of clay. Another thing that goes through this in other parts of Job is that they're speaking for God. And Job is clear that you're speaking falsely for God. And Job speaks to God. And I think that's a really important distinction that runs out runs throughout this poetry.
But at the same time, he is, in fact, having a very high opinion of God. Their opinion seems to be a lesser.
Well, they're defending God, right? They're saying God is just, and so you must be guilty, or some good will come out of this, or a number of other theodicies, right? On the face of it, it seems like they're pious, right? They believe in an all-good, all-powerful God, and they're ready to defend this God. The question then is whether that's the most faithful thing to do. Right?
Where's the wisdom?
Yeah, and here's Job. This doesn't sound as faithful, at face value at least. Job says, this is to God now. I cry to you, and you do not answer me. I stand, and you merely look at me. You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. You lift me up on the wind, you make me ride on it, and you toss me about in the roar of the storm. I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Surely one does not turn against the needy when in disaster they cry for help. Did I not weep for those whose day was hard? Was not my soul grieved for the poor? But when I looked for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. I don't know if my voice is the right one to read that. You could read it in a very different way. But this is a kind of protest to God. How dare you? I'm faithful. It's interesting. It sounds at face value like he's losing his faith. When I read this with my students, they think, "Uh-oh, watch it! Don't lose your faith." God might think of it as actually a very vital form of faith. God to Job, who had this? Thanks.
Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in its nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will it make many supplications to you? Will it speak soft words to you? Will it make a covenant with you to be taken as your servant forever? Will you play with it as with a bird, or will you put it on leash for your girls?
Yeah. Throughout this, we get these images of God playing with all of his creation. He mentions all these weird animals, the ostrich and Leviathan and Behemoth, and all these, you know, fantastical figures. And he's almost taunting Job, or very playful with him. Will you put a leash around Leviathan's neck and take him as a pet? Right? You can read that very harsh, like God is mocking Job, how dare you accuse me, right? Or as a kind of revelation of the free grace of God, right? God is playing with all of creation, and how dare you try to figure out this system of why people suffer, right? There's not going to be a one-to-one correlation here. My control is not a system. My providence isn't a system. It's a kind of marvel with and playfulness with all of creation. People dispute what to make of God. Whatever it is, it's not an answer to why Job suffers. Many read it as a non-answer. Where were you? I refuse to play your game, but let me give you a vision of all of creation. Who knows what that means? But what I do know is this. This is pretty clear at the end, the last chapter. After God gives these speeches out of the whirlwind, it says this. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." And they do it, and they make amends, and they're forgiven as well. I think it's a really weird and powerful ending to this book. These defenses of God, these seemingly very pious explanations for how God can still be omnipotent and all-powerful. God at the end says, "You have not spoken rightly. Job has." There's a kind of faithfulness in this exclaiming that God doesn't find in their explaining. His protests, his cries of desperation are more faithful, God is saying, than their very pious explanations about how God is good and powerful in light of suffering. He's the one speaking to God, and with an angry voice. But that is somehow more righteous in the eyes of God. I think that Christians with Jews, Muslims too, can learn from the book of Job that suffering isn't the kind of thing that we want to explain away, hold at arm's distance. But when we have compassion and empathy, suffering is at each of those words, suffering with others. When we suffer and when we suffer with others, even our cries of protest to God can be faith. We can read the Psalms, many of which are angry, songs of lament. And that's a sign of faith. We need not protect God, I think, from our pain and explain how God can be good and God can be all-powerful. But we can cry out from that pain and know that our God is one who hears that and who responds. Our faith, I think, is much larger than some of us might think. The fragile faith that might give way if God weren't all good or all powerful, if we couldn't solve these things. I hope that this is a start, this session is a start of thinking about that faithful response and thinking about how we can hold our suffering in relation to God that far outstrip these kind of ways of explaining. So thanks for tonight, and I hope this conversation can...